Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 51st installment of the podcast from Research to Reality, Hewlett-Packard Labs podcast. It's my great honor and pleasure to host Ray Bozelet. First time, the third podcast that was recorded with a single person.
Thank you.
Welcome, Ray.
It's an honor.
Go ahead.
I just said it's an honor.
Well, but there's a good reason for that. But before we get to the reason, tell us a little bit about yourself, even though this is third time, some people may be watching you the first time.
Understood. Ray Bozelet. I'm the director of the large-scale integrated photonics lab at Hewlett-Packard Labs. I've been with labs 30 years now. I've worked on a wide variety of projects. When I started the LSIP group about 15 or 16 years ago, we were focused on photonic interconnects. And now we've branched out and we're working very hard on using optics, integrated optics, to do, for example, computing.
So the theme of this year's podcast is technical leadership.
Okay.
And one form of leadership is becoming fellow. And you just became a fellow. And you didn't become fellow once, but twice.
I'm starting to get the hang of it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just among the first ones. You're going to continue. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Okay, well, I've in the past, I became a fellow of the American Physical Society and the Optical Society of America, which is now called Optica, for reasons that escape me, to be honest with you. And then recently, I was elevated to fellow by the IEEE and by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I think I'm done now. I don't know if I can be fellow of anything else, to be honest with you.
So you're a quadruple fellow?
Yes. Yes, I am.
So what does it mean to you to become fellow of these societies?
You know, to be honest with you, the first thing that occurs to me when an honor like this comes around is gratitude. I have not earned any of these honors solely based on my own wisdom or genius or hard work or anything else. I, along the way, have built a fantastic team of extraordinarily able people to do world-class research, and I could not have done any of this, and I wouldn't have even been a single fellow if I hadn't had their amazing work, enthusiasm, and support. And so that's just the people who helped me do the work. You know, when you think about, well, the IEEE fellow is a good example, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but you were the one who pestered me into actually going ahead and looking at the nomination form and filling it out. And John Bowers at UCSB, the professor there, was the person who nominated me. And then he went and found people who wrote letters. And so here's this ostensible honor that has been given to me, but I needed a kick in the pants from you. I needed to be nominated by a professor at UCSB, and then he had to go ask a bunch of other people who presumably know me well enough to write letters to help me out. And so, you know, I'm getting help below and at my side with all of the people I work with on my team, and then I get the help of the broader community when the time comes to actually apply for elevation. And so this has always been the case, where other people make it possible for these opportunities to flow to you. And when you forget that, you make a big mistake of the message of what these honors actually may mean.
So you just explained semi-process for becoming IEEE fellow. How did you become the other fellow?
The AAAS? Yeah. It's the oldest scientific society in the U.S. And to be honest with you, that one just caught me completely unawares. Their process is to, behind the scenes, I got to look for people to elevate. And so I was asked by the head of the industrial section of the AAAS if I'd be willing to send them a brief CV with, say, my top 10 publications and things like that. Okay. Well, they took that and then wrote the form themselves and found people who were AAAS fellows to write the letters. And so that one really, I'm grateful that they did it, that they thought I was worthy of it. Again, it's based on all the work that I've done with people on my team. But it took me by surprise. So I did almost none of the work, the actual process to achieve that honor.
Directly not, but indirectly a lot.
Indirectly. I did a few things.
So when I think about you as a technical leader, what stands out immediately loud, crystally loud, is all these funding that you were able to achieve. How do you do that? Can you tell us so that the rest of the community?
Yeah, I realize that some of this is not necessarily directly applicable to the academic world, and it's fairly unique to us as researchers in an industrial environment. But really, it starts from an interest in changing the world in some interesting or significant way. And then you want to be able to articulate why that's important and how you would do it, what you would deliver. And you begin to talk to internal and external sponsors. You look for a program manager at a government organization, for example, like DARPA or the DOD, other parts of the DOD or the DOE, to try to find someone who looks at the world in a way very similar to yours, has a vision similar to you, so that it's a real partnership. If you walk into, especially if you're from industry, and you walk into a meeting with a DARPA program manager, and you clearly think of this person as a bag of money, you're gonna get nowhere, okay? So the first thing you have to do is try to establish the relationships with people who are, whose job it is, whose career it is to provide opportunities for ideas that they believe in. So finding the right partner is really critical. And that's creating the opportunity, but then, a funding opportunity announcement comes out and it's time to write a proposal. And I have written some spectacularly terrible proposals in my career, but I've learned from that process. And I have learned that it's extremely important to have a crystal clear idea of the tangible artifact you will demonstrate at the end of the program. So Stephen Covey, I think, was the guy who said, begin with the end in mind. You don't just go to, you don't respond to a funding opportunity announcement with, we're gonna get these people together and we're gonna do this work and in the end we'll make some slides and we'll do stuff. You want to imagine yourself for 30 minutes in the room with the program manager after 3 or 4 or 5 years with their boss. And you're gonna spend 30 minutes showing them this absolutely dynamite demo. And they're gonna be so pleased because they've helped you bring this into the world. And if you've chosen the right partner, they even got in the trenches with you and did some of the technical work, helped make some of the decisions. And the program manager's boss thinks, my God, this was really worthwhile. Now, sometimes we fail. Research is hard. But that shouldn't hold us back. Still, you think about what is the demonstration at the end that brings all of this work together and makes it clear why we started in the first place, why it was so important for us to create this partnership. And if you look at it that way, you write a different proposal than any other way. I did some hilariously stupid things like, I've got 3 months to go before the proposal goes in. I spend 2 months writing the technical part of the proposal. Then I read the stupid BAA and find out that, oh wait, first I wasn't really responsive. Then two, I used the wrong font size and now I'm 30 pages over. I was hilariously inept. But if you're willing to listen to program managers and you're willing to be honest with yourself about your mistakes, you will learn and you'll eventually become more successful. And in my case, one of the differences, I think, is if I'm a faculty member and I decide I want to do something, I do it. And then students come along and they work for me. But I've got a bunch of really super smart, talented, stubborn people who work for me, who if they don't think it's a good idea, aren't gonna do anything. So the way I've built my lab, and we can talk about that if you want to, it's different than I think the way most organizations are set up, and they aren't going to waste time doing something they don't believe in. So you've got to have a program manager that believes in you, and then the people who work with you have to believe in it too.
This really surprised me. I've never seen any stubborn people around.
Me neither, especially in my lab.
You mentioned 30 minutes rule, but earlier you were telling me about 30 minutes and 1 minute rule.
Right. So if you, occasionally I get asked to help people with a proposal, and I'll read it, and I try to get them to come up with a 30 minute, you know, at the whiteboard, sketch out a presentation of a demonstration of the technology or the scientific result, what you will show. And they'll say, oh, I don't know, I can't do it in 30 minutes. That doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, it's gonna take some while to make some slides. No slides. What's the demo? I don't know how to do it. I say, okay, now do it in 1 minute. Do it in 1 minute. Tell me what you're gonna do in 1 minute. And they say, well, if I can't do it in 30 minutes, I can't do it in 1 minute. And I say, well, then you're gonna lose.
Yeah.
You don't have a chance. So it's a question of how crisply and clearly you can express the end result, the end goal, to someone who is at least nominally interested in hearing what you're going to do. And if you can't do that, the proposal you're going to write is going to be garbage.
What I learned from you for other purposes, not for funding necessarily, although it's very useful there, is the quad chart.
Oh, right. The quad chart forces you to come to terms with what it is you're promising, how you're getting paid, what the collaboration looks like. And there's two different kinds of collaboration diagrams. One of them is you got a large number of collaborators all running on parallel tracks who will give independent demos or slide decks at the end. And the other, like our DARPA Quick program, which we just signed today, there will be a press release about that at some point in the future. But we are working to get our subcontractors now to sign with us. And when you look at the organization chart for it, it's just four organizations lying one on top of the other, all working on all of the parts. And then can you express the risks and explain what it is you're going to do if one of the risks gets triggered? And then the other one is, what is really innovative about your work? So you've got, you know, the what, you've got the how and the who. You've got an opportunity to explain, this is why this is such an amazing opportunity. This is what we're going to bring into the world that wasn't there before, how we're going to do it. And then you've also got, here's what could go wrong and what we're going to do if it happens.
Very nice. So there's this hidden third dimension of mapping all these themes on top of it. Now, thinking about your Covey's quote, think with the end of your mind, you are slowly but eventually reaching the end of your career. What is most gratifying in your career so far?
Oh boy. So I'm at my retirement party 20 years from now. And
20 to 30.
20 to 30 years from now. And I'm talking about what it is that I did.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, you know, I'm just trying to leave something behind. I am trying to teach people how to think about their own careers, their own work, in such a way that there is a real career arc where they will get better over time, where they will have more impact over time, where they will be able to build their own teams and teach them the same things. The technologies we work on are very ephemeral, but the more people that you can influence who can view their own opportunities, their own careers in a really positive way, to understand that being honest is a strength, being direct is a strength, being transparent is a strength, and to understand how to create an environment where people believe that they will be heard, that what they are working on will end up in the final result, that they aren't simply taking orders. We don't work that way. And so the It's leaving something behind in the minds and the hearts of the people who are have been part of my lab for such a long time. Nothing more than that.
Really nice, really nice. It's kind of a role model for inclusion.
I do the best I can.
Yeah. Now, there were multiple artifacts over your career. If we look, for example, in open source, what do you think? How important is it for us engineers?
It should be a lot more important. And I'm sad to say, you know, everything that we've done has been emphasizing hardware. And we've gone from a world where there was essentially no way to share data. There was no way to share code. There was no way to do any of that kind of collaborative work with the rest of the world, to an era where now it's possible, but I would say we have adopted these techniques, like putting your code on GitHub, right, out in the world, open source it. It's not something yet that we fully embrace. We've got one piece of code that we've worked on that is based on another piece of open source code that is becoming available via open source. But honestly, it we can do a lot better. And you do it with code, I think we could do it with data as well, particularly because, you know, when we do a paper now, we look at yield, we look at performance over a large distribution of devices, even if we're publishing in Nature Photonics. So that's what we bring instead of just doing the hero device kind of a paper. So I have not been a terrific role model in open source, but I'm a believer, and I think we could do better. And I'll tell you what I'm thinking of. This is personal, but I've been working on a book on laser modeling for about 30 years that is based on lecture notes that I wrote when I was part-time teaching at the University of Washington. And over the course of time, I reduced those notes from written on paper to LaTeX. Or LaTeX, depending on, you know, tomato, tomato. And I've thought that, you know, when I finally do retire, I think I'll go to the company, I'll say, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to put my laser book on GitHub and let other people work on it too, because there's an awful lot in it that I don't think I'll ever get to. And so I think some of the things that I've got in that book are unique. Maybe some of it's wrong. But instead of having this introduction to a book where you say all of the mistakes are mine, I'd like to have one where I say a lot of people have worked on this book, and so many of them have made mistakes, me included. But so this is just a toy idea, but I'm becoming enamored with it over time.
So not just open sourcing book, but also crowdsourcing.
Exactly, exactly. So people who are better artists than I am, for example. Oh my God, I could use that.
So going back from books towards papers that you mentioned, how important are they? How important is publishing, patenting?
I think that it varies, obviously. And if you are someone in academia, publisher perish is real. In industry, I think that it is a missed opportunity to view nearly everything you do as some sort of a trade secret. I think that publishing is an incredible recruiting tool. I will occasionally go to a conference and give a keynote or plenary address and talk about our publications, and I get young people. Well, and if I say at the end of the talk, I'm hiring postdocs, I'll get inundated. You know, I'll be the most popular guy at the bar, and I won't even be buying. And it's because they see what we're doing, they see how we're doing it, and they're interested. And so I think publishing is a great way to recruit, but it's also a great way to just add to the community, you know, to add to the field, to the whole field, you know, photonic interconnects, optical computing. These big papers come out, but really they're all just tiny steps. Mm-hmm. And participating in that idea flow, becoming part of that community that's taking those tiny steps. Even to take those tiny steps, you have to be part of an elite community, and you have to work hard to stay there. And so publishing papers means that you're as good as the best people out there because you're publishing in the same places they are. And so you know that your skills are tuned, right? And I think that publishing is one of the very best ways to make sure that your skills are absolutely on point.
You mentioned bar. We'll get to the bar later. But in the meanwhile, is there still a role for standards in your area, in other areas?
That's a really great question. And I know that lots of people believe hugely in standards. And in both photonic interconnects and photonic computing, there aren't any. And I'm not convinced that they are important yet. One of the reasons is that in the world of photonic interconnects, for both data centers and HPC, they're vertical industries. And so you've got people who are basically doing their own thing, making their own stuff, and relying on their products for return on investment. So it's my NRE, it's my ROI. Go ahead and make a standard all you want. I don't care. I'm just going to make sure that, for example, if there's a socket that I have to plug into, that I am compatible with that socket. But everything from one socket to the other, that's just me. What we need in silicon photonics, for example, is a horizontal industry, something that looks a hell of a lot more like silicon electronics. Then standards will become very important, because you don't want to go get one flavor of silicon photonics at Fab A and a different flavor at Fab B, right? It'd be crazy do that in the electronics world. And so as the optics industry becomes horizontal, and I still, you know, I have a vested interest in seeing that happen. I really want to see it happen. I think the interconnect research we've been doing for the last 15 years, that is the best vehicle to get it out into the world and have an impact. But I think the difficulty we face right now is there are a couple of big companies in silicon photonics. They're vertical, and it might even be a little bold right now to say that silicon photonics is a real industry.
For acronym aficionados, just a reminder, ROE, return on investment.
ROI is return on investment. NRE can stand for one of a number of things, but we'll just call it non-recoverable expenses related to engineering.
DOD, Department of Defense.
Department of Defense,
DOE.
Department of Energy.
Okay. We usually also talk about broader good. You spoke about diversity, equity, and inclusion, but tell me, how does your work contribute to humanity?
That's a really great question. And let me give you an example of how it's very hard to estimate that in any concrete way. So, early career example. I worked on this handheld scanner, which the internal code name for it was Zorro. There was a rationale for that, it doesn't matter what it was, but it was pretty cool. You could basically just take this handheld scanner, which had these two navigation sensors on other side, on either side, you know, as big as a horseshoe, and a contact image sensor in between, and you could sweep it over a large surface with print on it, like a newspaper, and it would stitch it together and turn it into a document, like a PDF. And then you could squirt it out at a printer and it would print. And it sounds ridiculous in the world of cell phones and scanners today, but in those days it was really a big deal. And HP did a remarkable job of making sure no one ever understood what it did or why they should buy it. They called it the CapShare, which I don't even know what the hell that was supposed to mean at the time. But brand names are not my specialty, so maybe they knew something that I didn't. But what was funny was that sensor, I worked on the navigation sensors, the lasers, the cameras, the algorithms. And that sensor ended up in the optical mouse. And so I remember when 250 million optical mice had been produced. 500, somebody told me recently it's a billion. They probably don't use that sensor anymore. But what kind of, so that's probably the thing that has touched most people's lives. Most people. You know, I worked on other printer projects. I've developed a lot of intellectual property and tried to lead the field in silicon photonics, convince people that WDM is the answer, convince people that 1310 nanometers is the answer, with, I would say, a pretty reasonable impact when you look at how the publications in the field and the conferences have evolved. Does that stuff matter as much as the optical mouse? And if not, then what would you say the impact of the optical mouse is? And so the greater good is the way I would present it is that I am always trying to look for a way of applying integrated optics to helping people solve communication or computing problems that they can't solve now. And then to rely on the people who actually make systems to have an impact on the world. And so I'm reluctant to say I've had a big impact on the world, but I'm willing to say I've at least had a small one.
Well, I would respectfully think that only this mouse made you deserving of this quadruple fellowship, let alone everything else.
Yeah, well, I wasn't directly involved in the mouse project, and whenever I tell people about the optical mouse, they'll say, "Oh, you must be a billionaire." I said, "No, no. How much did you get for it? $1,000? That's what you got for a patent being filed." Now, and so the remuneration isn't the big deal there. It's just seeing people use something you worked on that's fun.
That's most satisfying in my mind as well. But here's the last question that is really interesting to me. And I'd like to go back to standards and tie to bars. What is a good standard for choosing scotch in a bar?
Excellent. Okay, so first of all, you have to know whether you prefer Islay or Speyside. The Islay scotches are going to be a little smokier. Some of them are challenging, but you need to know which side you're going to go. And then you need to know whether you prefer something that I'll say, 80 proof and something that's cask strength. So in other words, what kind of a day have you had, right? And I generally prefer the Speyside scotches. But one thing is certain, regardless of which scotch you choose, always have it neat. Do not put water ice in it. If some of the smokier scotches, if you put stones in that you've had in your freezer, I got that for Christmas once, and I thought a couple of them had opened up nicely. Cask strength Speyside scotch, 3 cold drops of water, tends to open it up, but never water ice. It's an insult to good single malt scotch.
I heard a story that if Scottish people thought that it would be drunk with ice, that they would have packed it that way.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very good point. Their wisdom goes beyond what you'd ordinarily associate with people who drink a lot of whiskey.
Thank you very much, Ray. So much learned from you
today.
Certainly.